he kind of he does the farming here. The youngest brother, he kind of does the tourism bit, and then, as I mentioned, Tony is the middle brother,
yeah.
And he's the vice principal at the Lutheran School in Dar Al Kalama Elementary School and High School in Bethlehem. And so these are good folks, they've been hanging on their land. The thing I remember about Dahir saying it last time is that the settlers offered him basically a blank check for this this land, and he said, "I don't sell my mother." That's the kind of person he is. This is his land.
Yeah.
It's been in the family since 1922, and Dyer is not going to let it go. Amen.
I will stay here all the life out, all the life.
Okay,
we come.
Okay. Let's go. This is Dahir, Dawood. The right one here, Nasser, one of the three brothers who took the farm. And these, are connected with Sabino. And we are from all over the United States, from Kansas City, from Iowa, from Portland, from Seattle, from Iowa, of all places, from Philadelphia, from Virginia, from San Francisco, from Houston, and from Iowa again. So we're represented, and I'm a member, so that's the important thing. Okay. So maybe I will go there. It's better, I think.
Okay. It'll be easier to see you.
So welcome to the Ten of Nations. Thank you so much for taking the time to visit us here. My name is Dawood. Dawood is David. Was born in Bethlehem. Finished my school in 1989. It was during the first Intifada. Friends of Sabil, you know a lot about the situation. But during the Intifada time, the universities were closed because the Israelis said at that time, schools, universities are places where young people come together. So they closed the schools, so we lost a generation of young people who did not do anything, except some of them, they were throwing stones on Israeli military cars. Now, I landed in Austria, and I visited a Bible school there. And then I came back in 1991. The university was opened, and I was studying business, and I have a BA degree in business. And then I continued my studies with tourism in Germany. Tourism is something important for the Holy Land, because this country is being visited by, in general, maybe 1.5 million tourists coming every year to the Holy Land. But most of them are Christian groups coming to visit. And they're supposed to walk where Jesus walked, but they end up running where Jesus walked. Because there is no time. Always in a rush. So, is it true? I mean, in general speaking, yeah. And that's especially for the people who are coming to visit the Palestinian areas. Imagine in Bethlehem, there are about 7,000 guests coming daily to see the Church of Nativity. So the bus stops near the square. I mean, then the guide is taking the group into the church. There is no space there, so something can be, he says something. And they said, that's it. They take some pictures and then they go home or they go back to Jerusalem without knowing that much about the situation in general and without knowing that among the Palestinians there are also Christians. Because many people, they don't know that. When I was studying in Austria and in Germany, many people, they kept asking me, I was talking in churches, when did you convert? And the answer is 2,000 years ago. So we exported Christianity from here. Many people, they mix religion with politics, and they think, that all Arabs are Muslims, and not only Muslims, radical Muslims, which is not the reality here, because we have people, Christians and Muslims, going to school together. You know, I have three children, and they are at the Lutheran school, where you have around more than 75% of the students are Muslims. So children are growing up together. Now, the other thing is that it's important for every group to come and meet the living stones of the country, and to get in touch, to learn about the country, to see the historical places, the religious places, etc. But at the end, also to meet the people. And when I'm talking about the people, I'm talking about Jews, about Christians and Muslims. Since I'm married now, I have three children, and my wife is doing also a women project in the village. I will be talking about it later. But our situation here is totally connected with the political situation. And I am sure you're aware of the political situation. After the peace agreements, the Israelis divided the West Bank into three zones, yeah? Three areas, A, B, and C. Where we are now, it is area C. Area C, which is totally under Israeli control. And Area C is making more than 65% to 70% of the West Bank. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk as Palestinians, when we talk about a state, where are we going to establish the state? We are not in charge. Thank you. Mm-hmm. We are not in charge of land. We are not in charge of resources, and we are not in charge of borders. And those are the three basics to achieve a state. So we are in charge of people. And that's why on what is called Area C, the Israelis are trying to create facts on the ground in terms of building settlements. And now to give you some figures here, when we talk about Area C, which is about 70% of the West Bank, there are about 150,000 Palestinians living on Area C, only from 1.5 million. In the West Bank. On the same area, there are about 350,000 Israeli settlers. So now with the time, the number of Israeli settlers will be more, and the number of the Palestinian will be less and less, and then we will be totally isolated as Palestinians in the homelands. We are talking about which are the cities. The area A's. And at the end, this is not a state we are talking about. So this is a homeland. Now, back to our story, the family story, this piece of land was bought by my grandfather in 1916 during the Ottoman period. Two crazy things my grandfather did. The first one, he registered the land. And it was not the case with many Palestinians at that time, because the Ottomans wanted to get property taxes, and they demanded any Palestinian should register his land in order to pay taxes. And many Palestinians didn't do it because they said, why do we have to pay taxes to our occupiers? One day they will leave, which is true. At the end, the Ottomans said also, for the land that was not registered, if you leave your land not cultivated continuously for more than 3 years, the state has the right to declare it as a state land. Now, the British, after the Ottomans left, the British and then the Jordanians started to do the same. But with the Israeli occupation in 1967, they stopped Palestinians from registering their own land. Now, beginning of the 70s, they started to build settlements, and the easiest way to take land for the expansion of the settlements is to declare the piece of land as a state land, leaving the burden on the Palestinians to prove ownership. Now, many of the Palestinians, they do not have their title on paper, and they don't have land registration. So they could argue with this, which is also true. We are living here since generations, and I own this land from my father. and he got it from his grandfather, and so on. They said, okay, but according to the Ottoman law, you were not using the land for more than 3 years. And according to that law, this is a state land.
But they weren't using it because they had been kicked off the land.
Yes, I mean, they are not using it because of many reasons. You know, some of them, one reason is sometimes they don't allow you to cultivate. Mm-hmm. I will tell you personal stories here, you know. Also, agriculture is not a source of income for the people. So you invest and you don't have something back. So the new generation said, "What? There is no need, there is no purpose, I mean, to cultivate the land, to plant trees and to invest, and at the end you have no income." And also, the other stuff is, in other areas you need machines like big diggers and tractors and so on, and they don't allow us to use those machines, you know, in order to keep the land not cultivated. And the moment the land is not cultivated, they can declare it as a state land, saying that the land has no owner. So they prevent you from cultivation, and then they say,
yeah,
it's not cultivated because it has no owner.
But it's not their land.
It's not their land, of course. It's occupation. This is the problem we are actually facing as Palestinians here. And those laws, they are unjust laws for us Palestinians. They are just laws in order to take land and to control the area and to expand the settlement. Now, back to the story. The second thing, you know, I was talking about the first thing, which was the land registration. The second thing my grandfather did, he moved from Bethlehem and he used to live in a cave on the property. And it was unusual. That's why now many Palestinians are not living in general on their farms. They are farming the land, but going back to their communities in the villages or in the cities. So my grandfather wanted to do totally different because he wanted his children to grow up here. And this is exactly what happened. So after my grandparents passed away, my father and uncle took over. They continued farming the land, cultivating the land, etc., until they passed away. So they lived all their lives in caves on the property. Now, we as children and grandchildren, we grew up also that way, keeping the same tradition from my grandfamily and from my grandfather and uncle. And we continued on, you know, on and on. And in 1991, we heard by chance that the Israelis declared the whole area, including our land, as a state land. So they gave us 45 days to prove ownership. Actually, what they do is they just put a paper somewhere. You know, sometimes you don't find it. We found it by chance through a guy walking, crossing to the village, and he said, "Well, we saw some people putting papers here and there, and we went to Bethlehem to ask what's going on." Bethlehem was under the Israeli control at that time. And there was an office called the Absentee Property Office. Absentee Property Office, you know. So we asked, they said, "Well, your land is a state land because it has no owner." And we were given, as I said, 45 days. From those 45 days, we lost 15 days. Mm-hmm. And we had to react within those days and to appeal in the to the military court. And immediately we arranged, you know, we organized ourselves and we hired a lawyer that did this paperwork. And we presented, with the first session, our lawyer presented the papers from, you know, our own, you know, our title. And the Israeli military judge was shocked to see papers. They were not expecting us to have documents for the land. So immediately the case was postponed because there is no case to talk about. Nothing. Well, you know, you say it's a state land. Yeah.
Case closed.
No, normally, usually, case closed. But for them, they are. It's still open since 1991. We are in court since 1991, 12 years of legal battle in front of the military court, and now over 8 years in front of the Supreme Court, the High Court, with a financial burden of $150,000 until now. Now, what they are trying to do, they say something and we have to prove the opposite. For example, they said, this is a state land. Now, the burden is on us to prove it's a private land, you know. Then they said, okay, if you want to prove that, you need to survey the land again. Now, we have an old map for the land, an old land survey, goes back to 1922. They said, well, it was done by hands, so we need a new one. So, making a new one, we had to pay $5,000. And in order for a land survey to be recognized by the court, it should be signed by all neighbors. And we were given 35 days to do it. So, we had to run to our neighbors, Palestinian neighbors, and to encourage them to sign on our map. And some of them were suspicious. Why do you need our signature? Okay. Everybody knows this is your land. We managed to do it. We presented. And then they said, okay, we need to study it. And the case was postponed. And then they said, now we need eyewitnesses. We need people who lived here, farmed the land, etc., planting trees. And one time we brought 50 people, a big bus, to the military court, and we were standing 5 hours under the sun. And then a soldier came out and he said, we have no time to talk to you today. Come tomorrow. Yeah. You know? So always like obstacles. So then later on they said, your land surveyors are not recognized in Israel. So we had to hire an Israeli land surveyor. He had to go to Istanbul, he had to go to England to check old papers, new papers, maps, whatever, you know, and writing a report. We had to pay him alone $70,000. So we had to survey the land until now, maybe 11 times. And almost the same survey, because our borders are accurate, you know, we know all our borders. But still, they are making difficulties on us in order to voluntarily give up.
Mm-hmm. Or run out of money.
Right. Now, this is legally, but it didn't work so far. We are still here. We did not lose any part of the land. Now, they tried the second way, which is the second strategy, which is to put more physical pressure on us through the settlers. So, between 1991 and 2002, Israeli settlers came attacking us here, threatening us with guns, damaging our trees and our water tank, trying to build 3 times a road on our property in order to establish a settlement, which is the last Palestinian and also a Christian, the last Palestinian and Christian hill here. Mm-hmm. Surrounded by 6 Israeli settlements. And the idea is to build a settlement here, not only to control the hill, but also to control the Palestinian village from all sides, you know, to be isolated. And then the people, with the time, you know, they have no any source of income. They are disconnected from their communities, from their work in Bethlehem. So they will voluntarily leave the area. So the last time they came in 2002 with big machines. They started cutting the ground in order to establish, to build a road. We managed to stop them 3 days later by court. And the settlers were very angry, and they smashed 250 olive trees from our property. And of course, you know what is the meaning of an olive tree for a Palestinian. You know? We were very frustrated, and we went to the police, to the Israeli police, to claim damage, but nothing happened from their side. You know? So 3 weeks later, we received an email from a Jewish organization located in England called European Jews for Just Peace in Palestine. They heard about us and they sponsored this place with 250 olive trees, and they came and planted them. So this was for us a very positive sign of hope. Yeah. Now, with physical pressure, we have many stories to tell, but we are still here. As you see, we did not give up. Then they tried to buy the land from us. And one time in 2002, we got an offer. A phone call says, would you like to sell the land? And the offer was a blank check. Just write down how many millions of US dollars you want for this area. And Then a free access. Where do you want to go? To the United States, to Canada, to Australia? We will help you
to make the arrangements. Someone from the government?
We don't know. Just some. I said who's that? What's the just to give us names and you know. Said first, if you are interested to do it, then we can talk later. You know. And we said, as an answer, our land is our mother, and our mother is not for sale. Now they are using the fourth strategy, which is to isolate us. The road is blocked since 2001, and the wall is being built on Palestinian ground. You pass by the wall, yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, when the wall is finished, totally finished, this area will be outside the wall, which will be on the Israeli side of the wall. And this will prevent 25,000 Palestinians living in five villages to cross back and forth to Bethlehem easily. Imagine many people, especially from this dorf, from this village called Nahalin, there are about 200 teachers are teaching every day at schools in Bethlehem. And they have to be at 7 o'clock, around 7 o'clock at school. And there will be an access road for us, which is like a small tunnel under Road 60, under the settlers' road, and this tunnel will be totally under Israeli control. That means the trip to Bethlehem is not going to take, or the drive, half an hour. It will take maybe 5 hours on some days. And this will force many people to leave the villages and go to the cities, you know, in order to make it easy for them to cross to their work. And in other words, most of the Palestinian populations will be in Area A, what is called Area A, which are the cities. And of course, this is the future of the Palestinians, to live isolated from each other in the cities. And the city, I mean, if you're coming now from Bethlehem, it's like overcrowded in Bethlehem. It's now becoming impossible to live there, actually, you know. Two roads, so many cars, you know, and it's hot, so it's, and the air is not good, so it's like, diesel and benzene and whatever, you know. So at the end, this is the future of the Palestinians, according to the plan. So now, the restrictions continues here. We are not allowed to build anything on our land here. We have no access to running water, and no access to electricity. That means no development. And 2 years ago, we received here 9 demolishing orders for 9 structures we built without a permit. Among them are 4 tents. And when the Israeli officer came to give us the demolishing orders, I was pointing to him. I said first, is this law for Palestinians only or for both Israelis and Palestinians? He could not say for Palestinians only. He said for everyone. You build something without a permit, that's why you receive a demolishing order. I said, I accept it and understand it. Now, if we are equal, both under the law, I'm expecting you to go to my neighbors. And I was pointing to him on a settlement, an illegal yeah. settlement. There are illegal outposts built mm-hmm. after 2002 on private Palestinian lands, and the houses are built without a permit. I said, okay, I received a demolishing order for my tents, but now, you know, my neighbors should receive also demolishing orders for their houses. He said, this is not your business. So discussion ends. So then we appealed against the demolishing order, and many people helped us a lot, you know, internationally. They sent letters from the U.S., from Germany, from other countries. And because of this pressure, we managed to freeze the demolishing orders. Now 3 months ago, on the middle of February, we received another 3 cultivation stop orders. Actually, we did not receive them by hand. We found them on the field. One is on a tree, the other one on a wall, and the third one, we found it on a fence. You know? And we were given 45 days. They did it a day before we had a storm here. It was windy and rainy. And maybe many of our neighbors, they did not find their papers. Mm. You know? So we were lucky, we found the papers, we appealed, you know, we appealed against them. And just recently, on the 21st of May, we found a paper in the valley, a demolishing order for a system. So the journey continues. So we have now four legal battles are parallelly to each other. You know, the one from 1991, the second one, the demolishing orders 2 years ago, the third one, the cultivation stop orders a couple of months ago, and the fourth one is the demolishing order for the system. So it's a big frustration for us. And by the way, this is not a unique story. You hear it everywhere. Of course, it's like I can say it could be a unique story because this is the only story that is still in court since 1991. Here. Now, what is happening here is happening. It's happening everywhere in the West Bank, and this situation is forcing Palestinians whether to react in a violent way or just to sit down and cry and blame the other and be a victim, resign, or leave. Those are the three options we are facing. So there are people who believe in violence, but what can we achieve with violence except violence? The majority of the people, the Palestinians, are sitting down, you know, being passive, waiting for a political messiah to come for salvation. And the third group, among them are the best educated Palestinians and also the Christians, they are leaving the country. They don't see any hope for a better future. For us, we said from the beginning, we will never act in a violent way. We will never sit down and cry and blame the other. We refuse to be victims. And we said also, we will never leave the area. So we said, you know, we are people who believe in justice. They cannot force us to hate. And because we believe that people are created in the image of God and they are not created to hate each other. And we will never leave the area here. So we created a fourth way of action, a creative way of nonviolent resistance under the slogan, we refuse to be enemies. It is easy to say that, but it's very difficult to live it on the ground. And of course, it's a non-violent way of action, overcoming the obstacles with good, overcoming evil with good, overcoming hatred with love, overcoming darkness with light. And this is, by the way, a Christian way of non-violent resistance. So under that slogan, we created the Tent of Nations. And the idea of the Tent of Nations is to achieve two goals. The first one is to invest our frustration constructively, because our frustration is an energy. Might come out in a negative way and might hurt people, but we wanted to channel this pain to be in a constructive power. And the second goal is to open the land for people to come and learn, to come and see. And not only to come and see, but also to go and tell. Because we need the people to understand and to come together and build bridges of understanding, of reconciliation and peace, including Israeli people. We are inviting Israeli people, American Jewish, not to talk about peace, because it's impossible, you know, how can you speak about peace while you are living under occupation? Something is missing here, you know. So sometimes, like, you feel you have groups of Palestinians and Israelis coming together and talking about peace. I mean, with all respect, but this is. Because at the end of the talk, people are going back to their realities again. You know? And that's why something is missing. So we are not equal. We are not sitting around the same table and talking about an issue. You know? So that's why it's important for us to say we cannot talk about peace in this situation. But we are inviting people to open their eyes, to open their hearts. Because many Israelis, they say, we don't know, or they don't want to know. So come and see. You know, maybe you will hear difficult stories, but it's important for you to listen and to understand. And when we talk about occupation, this is how life looks like under occupation. And now I'm not expecting that much from you, but at least you heard. You listened to our story. And then if you would like to do that, anything, you go to your community and then try to spread the word and talk about it, you know. Or close the page and say, I don't want to deal with this issue. But at least you had the chance to see the other as human being and not as an enemy. So now the challenge was how to develop this place without water, without electricity, and without a building permit. It looks impossible, but nothing is impossible. So for water, we are totally depending on rainwater. We are collecting rainwater into systems. For energy, we have a solar power system sponsored by a German organization in 2009. We managed to do it. And by that, we have 4.5 kilowatt of electricity. It's enough. And we have a wireless internet here now. So, and by that, we did not receive any bills from the sun. Until now. You never know what might happen. But on the contrary, we managed to save more than $20,000 for diesel expenses since 2009. And we are talking about 3 hours of electricity every day using the generator. Now we are having 24 hours of electricity and without any costs. So it's not about electricity. It's not about water. And with building, we started building under the ground. We are not allowed to build on the ground. We started building under the ground, renovating existing caves. You know, but the idea is not about that. The idea is to show people, including Palestinians, that things are possible. Don't sit down, don't cry, and don't blame the other. You know, stand up, raise your voice, and start acting in a different way. Because when you act in a different way, you confuse the other, and you force the other to see you as human being. And this is important for us, you know. And this is our way of action here. So after we develop the infrastructure, we are doing here different kinds of activities and programs. We are starting every year with a tree planting project. We invite people to sponsor trees. We invite people to plant trees. We invite Palestinians, Israelis, internationals to come and plant for peace. When you plant a tree, especially an olive tree, you believe in the future. Especially, you know, like the first fruits might come after 10 years, the first olives. So it's a big investment for the future. When you plant a tree, you protect the environment, you make the land green, productive, and you keep it from the danger of confiscation. Because they have a law taken by, you know, from the Ottomans. If you leave your land not cultivated and planted, they will take it. So doing that always will make it difficult for land to be confiscated. And also we learn by that that peace should grow from the bottom up. You know, peace cannot come from up to down. We need the ground. The ground is missing. That's why, you know, we are talking about peace, but we are not making peace. And exactly this is what Jesus said, you know, blessed who are the peace makers. And he did not say the peace talkers. Yeah? Because it's easy to talk about something. Yeah, very easy. You know, but it's very difficult to realize it. And that's why, you know, you have always people talking about peace. You know, from up to down, and talking about it and negotiating and this and that, and at the end you don't see any fruits of peace. You know. But we need to cultivate the ground. You know, when as a farmer, you need to cultivate the ground a couple of times, prepare it for the winter, and then plant the seeds. And some of them are trees. Some of them might grow. Some of them might not grow. It's not an easy work, but at the end, if you give the tree enough water, enough care, the tree will find its, you know, roots. The roots will find their way into the ground, and then they can live for generations, especially the olive tree. And that's why it's important to do a lot from the bottom up. Now, the second program we are doing is the children's summer camp activities. We are starting, we are doing 2 weeks of summer camp for local children from Bethlehem area, both Christians and Muslims, from refugee camps. And we invite the children for 2 weeks, and we do this kind of work, like painting, mosaic, music. I mean, we want the children to discover their talents. And we have always a theme for our camp. So the next summer camp will be before Ramadan, which will start on the 20th, I think. And we have Muslim kids. So we started early this, we will start early this year. So the, it's going to be on the 9th of July for 2 weeks. And the theme is, with heart and hand, you change the land. So this is our title for the camp. And under this slogan or the, this title, we do different kinds of activities with the help of 12 international volunteers who are coming extra to help with the summer camp. At the end of the camp, we invite the parents to, you know, for a celebration to see what their children have done during the summer camp, and also to reach the parents, you know, to motivate them. Because we need our people to get motivated. Now, the third project we are doing is a women project in the village. My wife is a computer teacher, and she started this computer classes and English classes for women who do not have chances for education in the village. And the idea is not only about education, but also about women empowerment. Because we need the women to play a role in shaping their societies here. And we added now agricultural training and other workshops. We have also like first aid classes, you know, empowerment. And on the 27th of June, we have a video conference or a Skype call with a group of women in London, in the UK. So this is, we are trying to overcome our obstacles, you know, with internet and to get our voices to other people. And this is important for the women to get in touch with other women, learning about their society, not only to speak about our problems. Because you as internationals are coming to learn about our situation, and sometimes you help us indirectly to fall in the victim circle. Because you are expecting us to tell you more about how bad life is for us, how bad, you know. But at the end, you learn, and you go back home, and of course you do a lot in your communities, but then you leave us in our frustration. That's why it's important for us to speak about our frustration, but to say this is not the end, because we need to break the chains and move out of our circle and start acting in a different way, you know. So we have other projects going on, the harvest camps. We have the almond harvest next month. We are now in the apricot harvest. And almond harvest in July, we have the grape harvest in August, the fig harvest in September, and the olive harvest end of October. We have people coming to stay here in our tents. They can work the land in the morning, do field trips in the afternoon, and sit together around the fire in the evening for an exchange. We have volunteers coming to visit us for short and long term. We have long term volunteers coming between 6 months and 1 year, especially from Germany. Other volunteers are coming between 1 day and 3 months. So last year, we had more than 5,000 people came to visit here. International presence is very important here. It helped us a lot. And that's why we ask people to come even if they don't have enough time or much time. You know, just come. The moment you walk in here from the roadblock, it's important for the people to come and see and learn. But also, it's a sign of hope for us, you know. And in terms of like the legal battle, always they are asking us from where you have internationals on your property. So this is a good sign for us. It helped us a lot. Now, our situation is going to be worse. You know, it's of course we hope for the best, but we have to be prepared for the worst. So if we if they close the wall totally, this area will be on the Israeli side of the wall, and that's why it's important. It's urgent for us to make this place totally self-sufficient. So we invested in energy, and we hope by the end of the year to install 2 small wind turbines. And we are filtering now the gray water and using it for irrigation. An Israeli friend who was a settler before, he came here, and this visit, it changed his life. And he came back and built 4 compost toilets for us here. so in order to save more water. And we are trying to increase the land production, so to make this place totally self-sufficient. The big dream is one day to have a vocational training center here, focusing on alternative energy and organic farming. I believe in small steps. We do whatever we can within our capacities, but all those small steps together will definitely change the face of the situation. We have a website. You can learn more about our work, the work we are doing on the website, tendernations.org. And we started also with Friends of Tender Nations in North America. They are trying to bring me twice a year on speaking tours in the United States, to spread also, not to spread some of the good news, you know. So faith, love, and hope are the basics of our work here. And please don't forget that out of Palestine, there are still some good news. So I stop here. If you have some questions, please.
I don't want to detract from that wonderfully positive end note, but I was wondering if you could tell us about the roadblock here, how it happened, and why it hasn't been taken down.
Yeah, I mean, they came, the settlers, they call the army, and they tell, for security purposes, we need to close the road. You know? And so they come with bulldozers, and they close the road. And it's like, because it's, they say always for security purposes, we cannot do that much against them. So we cannot appeal and say, well, we need you to open the road. So it's for security purposes, you know.
So they would just fabricate a story about how...
There was no story to fabricate, because even in the worst years of the Intifada, nothing happened here. No attacks. No settler was attacked by a Palestinian or killed or something. Nothing. You know, but the idea is like, they don't want Palestinians to use that road, especially the farmers. And because when you have the road blocked, and then you need machines, you need the tractor to go through and cultivate the land, many of the Palestinians, they give up. They say, I cannot reach my land. And they leave it abandoned for a couple of years, and then they, of course, with aerial photographs, they can prove this land was not cultivated for 5-6 years, and then they come and take it. But security purposes is actually, you have so many things under it.
Right. It seems like the military is just doing the dirty work of the government land planners.
Actually, sometimes I say, you know, the settlers, they govern here. They are in charge of everything. I mean, of course, like sometimes, not directly, but sometimes through the army. They call and say, you know, they are doing this and that. So the army comes. Mm-hmm. It's good sometimes to challenge even the soldiers with those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. One time I was parking the car at the roadblock, and then the soldiers came, and they were very angry, and they were, you know, calling with a loudspeaker,
radio.
And then I was running to the car, because sometimes they can open it or just, you know, like blow it up. They say it's maybe there is a bomb inside it or something. So I went to the car, and, you know, the soldier was very angry. He approached me and he said, why you park your car here? You know, he was screaming at me. I said, because you are blocking the road. You know, he did not expect me to answer this question, to answer that way, you know. And there was a moment of silence, you know. And then I was in charge, you know. So he was, at the beginning, he wanted to make me feel, you know, very afraid and so on. But after this answer, I was asking him questions. I said to him, why you are closing this road? You know, he said, because of security purposes. And then it was in the afternoon, so some workers were coming down from the settlements, because Palestinian workers are building settlements. You know, this is also the sad story. Yeah. But they were walking down, and then I said, look, you know, the Palestinians are working inside settlements, and you say for security purposes, they are closing the road, but the Palestinians are walking out from the settlement, going home. You know, what's going on? He said, oh, I don't understand it either. So then sometimes when you challenge those people, they started to realize something is wrong here. And sometimes it's good to deliver a message, you know, to show the other that in front of you is not an enemy, is also a human being. You know, remind the enemy that you are not an enemy, in different words.
I'm interested about the notices that you find in the field on a tree. Do you get mail service anywhere in your name? In the name that this land is registered in? Because it seems that something as official as this kind of any notice that they would need to be sure you got it. That would be their
responsibility. Registered.
They don't have mail service like we have mail service.
Well, for my tax office, if it's very important, I get registered mail. They want me to sign. Yes, you got it. Your taxes are going to be more.
Yeah. But here, you know, you don't. You just sometimes they come. Like people are working with the civil administration school, and they come and they ask them to deliver papers. You know, and they don't come to the owners and say this is a paper. You did something wrong, or you know, this is state land. Sometimes they just put it there and take a picture. You know, yeah. We delivered it to the on the area. So one usually I saw them. Usually you have two people. One is putting this paper on a wall or something, and the other is taking a picture. You know, we delivered this, and he's talking also. So it's like a video to be sure it's done. You know?
But that's a rock or a tree, isn't a person.
Yeah, but this is the idea. You know, in order for the Palestinians not to find it, and then they, of course the Palestinians are given 45 days to act. But most of them, you know, they might find it later on because according to people not coming. Every day to their farms. So when you drive with a bus and you see like cultivated lands and plant, you know, trees and so on, not every day the farmers are going there. So they are going there for occasionally. You know, for example, preparing the land for the rain, cultivation, and then grooming the trees. You know, and then later on with the harvest. You know, and then the year to prepare the land for the rain again. So 4 or 5 times a year, you have people regularly on their farms. And that's why they won't be able to find them, those papers. But the moment the time is running out, and you as a Palestinian, you did not know about it. So they come maybe probably 5-6 months later. And then they start, let us say, digging a road through your land. And then you want to go and stop them. Then they will show you a paper, says, well, we gave you a paper 3 months ago or 5 months ago, and nobody reacted. So now for the Western ears, this is understandable. You know, they don't say we left the paper somewhere. No, we delivered the paper to you. You know, and then you did not respond. That means you have no title for your land. You have no paper for the land. And that's why you did not respond, and you know, automatically, you did not respond in the time we gave you, and that's why the government has the right to take the land.
I mean, it's not their land in the first place.
That's true.
To even make any judgment about it.
Yes.
Period.
Yes. It's occupied. Of course, it's occupied territory.
It's illegal under international law, yes. Even to consider giving away.
Yes.
The land.
But for the Israelis, they don't say it's occupied territory. They say it's Judea and Samaria, and we are in charge of this area. You know, that's why. So, they are not recognizing what is done on the West Bank as an occupation. So that's why they say, even for this military committee that is responsible for the West Bank, they say the civil administration of Judea and Samaria. This is what it's called.
But not military occupation.
No, they don't say that. It's a civil administration of the...
With soldiers.
I want to thank you for your presentation,
You're welcome.
For the finest representations of what it means to be a Christian that I would hope to hear from anywhere. So it's a privilege to be able to be here.
Thank you.
And hear your theology and it of this place. And thank you. I wanted to ask, you said the cycle of victimhood was something you have to work to prevent, because in telling the stories over and over, you're also reinforcing a self-image of victim, which is problematic, which is part of what's created this whole conflict to begin with,
right.
If you think about the victimhood of Jewish people as well. Who inspired you? Where did you learn these concepts? I know it's taken a long time, but are there particular writers or teachers or thinkers or just your experience?
Well, you know, I mean, what we do here is actually based on faith. The first thing is based on faith. And I grew up in a Christian family, you know, and my grandfather was a spiritual man, and my father was evangelist, and was working on, like, doing children work, house meetings, and so on, you know. So we grew up that way. And of course, like, I'm inspired also by also other people, you know, of course. But this is, you know, our way of action here is actually did not come from today and after tomorrow. You know, it's like we went through this process since 1991 with difficulties and problems and so on. But the Tent of Nations we started actually in 2001. You know, it's like a process of experiencing this situation, and then thinking about actions that we might do in order to prevent this kind of thing, but it was not so easy. You know? So like it's a process. But I'm very very happy to be with the Tent of Nations to be in this situation now. Because I want to see the positives out of it. With this story, with this difficult story, and I'm trying to write a book about our struggle to keep the land, and I will mention the difficult stories also we experienced here. We managed, like in the middle of suffering, you can encourage other people. You know, that's the faith in action. Yeah? Because with our story, we managed to inspire so many people, locally, internationally, and even Israelis, you know, with problems, with daily problems we are facing, still we are bringing hope with this example to so many other people. And this is actually what inspires me too.
What's going on with this? So, since we last saw each other, they've issued this demolition order for the cistern?
Yes. This is recently, the 21st of May.
So dig that, is that what they're saying?
Yes.
But you've had that for
8 years, the system was built, you know. But, I mean, the thing is, they tell you it's without a permit.
Uh-huh.
But the moment you apply for a permit, they deny it.
They deny it anyway.
Yes, without giving you a reason. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the tents, they said to us, it's without a permit. Then we applied. 3 times you applied, and each time we had to pay, you know, like $1,500 always, like, you know, to have a land surveyor and do this paperwork and so on. And at the end, 40 days later, you receive a negative answer without any reason. So in any country, you expect, you know, of course, like if you want to do an extension to your house, you apply for a permit, you do the paperwork, and at the end, you receive an answer, no, because, or yes, go on. But here we receive no without why.
What's going to happen if for some reason they don't postpone your, like, you can't win with that.
They might come and demolish.
And then yes. What for you?
We have to prevent that from happening. Yeah. You know? But for me, it's important not to stay in that situation. Mm-hmm. So the moment I start to think, tomorrow they might come. Of course, we are sometimes under this pressure. Of course, mm-hmm. Sometimes we see them coming to the road.